the conversation around Empire was, that's what Empire, all they do is hire the violent rappers. You could arguably say the same thing about Interscope. There was a point in time where if you weren't violent, you weren't Interscope. Or if you weren't violent, you better be Will I Am.
Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. When I walk down the street, I'll see people wearing the merchandise from media companies and entities all the time. I'll see people wearing A24 products. I'll see people wearing NPR hats and handbags. I'll even see the occasional Whitney Houston or Ice Cube t-shirts. But I rarely see the merchandise from a record label. I may have seen this more often years ago back in the CD era with Rockefeller and Def Jam and companies like that, but I rarely see that today. Maybe once in a while I'll see a Dreamville sweatshirt here or there, especially if I'm somewhere like Vegas, but you just don't see that often. And it's not a coincidence. A lot has changed in audio and in music, specifically in the streaming era, that has made these record labels shift from having a prominent place when it comes to consumer brands to a lot of them having more B2B brands. And to break this all down and talk about why this is, I'm joined by Justin Hunt. He's a well-known and respected journalist in hip-hop media over the years from his work at Hip Hop DX, Revolt, and other outlets. And today we're here to talk about a number of things. What happened to these brands? What do they look like today? Are there any lessons from the companies that are doing this well? And if anyone wants to start off, what's the best way to go about this? So let's take a trip down memory lane and we start our conversation back to when record label brands meant a lot more. All right, today we're going to do a breakdown on record labels as brands, but specifically, what happened? I felt like there was this era where a lot of these labels had some strong consumer brands, but a lot's shifted in the industry. And I'm here to talk about it with my guy, Justin Hunt. First time on the pod. Welcome, man.
Word up, man. Thank you for having me, man. It's a pleasure. It's an honor.
When you think about record labels historically, you think about brands and the ones that truly identified with music lovers, music fans. You and your journey as a music fan, what are some of the ones that stick out to you? Like, what are some of those record label brands? Like, what did they do? What made them effective?
Most of my time growing up, I think most of us got into the things that we found cool from an older cousin, brother, family member, sister, whoever. And my cousin Shah was my Jedi Master or whatever everything cool was, right? It was Nintendo, it was video games, it was Marvel, Star Wars, and it was hip hop, right? This is New York City in the 80s. And there was no more prominent brand at that point in time, at least in our household, and I would say within hip hop in general, than Def Jam Records. You know what I mean? You knew when a Def Jam artist came out, right? You knew what Rick Rubin's sound was. And that's sort of, you know, whether it's the Beastie Boys, whether you're talking about LL Cool J, whether you're talking about Run DMC in that era, you know, you knew what that stood for. And similarly, at the, you know, a little bit later, you know, when you get to like Death Row Records, even Ruthless Records, you knew you're going to have some gang stories that were going to be told in one way or the other. You knew that, especially by the time you get to the G-Funk era, you knew it was just a different type of sampling with some crazy engineering that just sounded completely on its own. Those are probably the two biggest ones at the earliest points in my life. But even if you look at like Rap-A-Lot Records, or if you look at other collectives, it seemed like that everything was coming in organically and intentionally from inside the building. They had an idea of the market that they wanted to touch. They had an idea of what sound they wanted to have, because it was at that point in time, it was not cool to have the same sound as someone else. And also you knew the characters and the people. If your entry point is LL Cool J, you're going to find the Beastie Boys really quickly. And so the ties that bind were just felt intentional. It felt strategic, organic. That to me is part of why I think about that era as being so impactful and important to me. But also I think there's a huge part of the underlayers of what became known as the golden era. There was so much of that and it was so rich.
You bring up a few things that I really agree with. And when I think back to Def Jam specifically, there was a fight for survival. There was a fight for legitimacy that you were seeing there. They were creating music and they were creating a sound that the mainstream major record labels weren't looking at. And when you do that, it becomes a bit of this forcing function that makes you even more likely to find a way to stand out, find a way to do things more innovative. You've heard Russell Simmons and the other founders and leaders talk about this. And then you saw that continue in the 90s. And I do think that the record labels in the 90s relatively maybe had a little bit more major record label support than they did in the 80s, especially when you're talking about hip hop and R&B, but still it wasn't anywhere near where it is today. So you have that push for legitimacy, and then you have each of these labels needing to have a distinct sound. You look at 1998, Cash Money, everything that they did up to that point to then be able to get a $30 million deal. That's because they had a distinct sound. You had the in-house production, you had Manny Fresh. And even if you look at some of the other labels that still did things with hip hop as well, you look at a label like Interscope, and they had the Death Row partnership, but they also had Nine Inch Nails. They also had No Doubt. Even though they had other genres besides hip hop, they had a bit of this aura and a bit of this edge of trying to have music that seemed a bit more edgy or a bit different in that way. But I also think that part of it is how people purchase the main product that you see, because you go to the store, you go to, whether it's Strawberries, you go to Tower Records, Sam Goody, wherever, you're going there to buy a Dr. Dre album. You're going there to buy this. And on the label of the album, you see the record label name. You see them have the promo for the new album that's going to be coming out in a couple of weeks or a couple of months. And you even have the design of looking at those images, whether you have the pen and pixel from Master P and No Limit, and all of those identifiable things. And I know we're talking a lot about hip hop and even R&B when you look at Uptown Records and those, but it was also pop music as well, because you saw Jive Records and the stuff they did with Teen Pop and Britney Spears and those kind of artists. But I think everything that we're talking about now shifted once streaming came through, once piracy, and once everything shifted, and then the store was no longer going to the record store to buy the particular artist album. It was going to these portals, whether it was iTunes and then eventually Spotify and the streaming services, to then buy the product. So that changes everything in terms of what that experience looks like.
You know, even to predate that slightly, I think the Federal Communications Act, that allowed for broader consolidation in the media space. If there used to be a ceiling, a limit where you had to have at least 30 different radio stations, that was cut down to 10. If you look at 1996, it's actually a really interesting year, especially on the hip hop side, where you start to see divergence between certain types of artists. Like, that's where you really start to see mainstream and underground become part of a conversation. In 96, you know, if you got It Was Written, you followed one path. But if you got Stakes Is High by De La Soul, that brought you towards Raucous Records. That brought you towards a lot of other what would become known as independent artists. So that previous consolidation was the first time I think you started seeing some segmentation in the space, which allowed for, which disrupted the way people thought about the market in general, where these artists fit. Because before that, it was just rap. Rap was just rap, you know what I mean? And then you get to everything that you pointed out with the internet, and you get streaming platforms. And now we're farther away from what these brands even really are. And now everything is really market cap driven. And most importantly, everything is really share price driven.
All of these entities, the more that the M&A deals happen, the more they combine together. You are a vehicle to capture market share. If you had 13.7 last year and you now have 13.9 this quarter, great. If you go down to 11 point whatever, someone's going to be calling for your head. And that's just a very different thing. And of course, sales were always part of the game, but there's just been more and more of this that continued to happen. And I think now when you look at things in the streaming era, it's interesting because you had blog era, and then after the blog era, you did have some more labels that came through. But it's been interesting to look at some of the hip hop labels and even some of the R&B labels of the 2010s or of the streaming eras, and see how some of those compare, looking at labels like a 300 or a QC or a Dreamville. And when I think about them specifically on the consumer brand side of things, I mean, I'll walk around and I'll still see people wearing Dreamville shirts, maybe not as much as I would have seen 5 years ago, but I still see them out. And if you go to LA, you may see some TDE gear and places like that. So some of these things still do exist, but I would be stretching if I was to say it existed in the same way that it did back in the CD era or even in the 2000s.
I'm not sure how many labels are strategizing in that way. A TDE, a Dreamville, some of these streaming era labels, in a lot of ways, they're just bursting onto the scene, right? So they don't have a legacy connection to hip hop fans a generation older. in the same way. But I think if you look at just the monetization of an artist, labels in general are looking for as many different ways to find revenue streams. And a lot of times that's just selling merch. I do appreciate about the Dreamvilles and the QCs and the TDEs is that they all still do have very distinct sounds, like the type of artists that they target and the markets that they target. They have this like very cool balance between superstar revenue driven, but also targeted certain markets, you know, college age bohemian and supreme lyricism and relatable content type stuff. Like you say, same thing about TDE with a West Coast vibe. It seems like they put a tent pole in each of the communities. And I think that at the same time, those labels, because they came up in the streaming era, I think there's a closer connection with the consumer who also came up in that era. I'm not quite sure if people, you know, always a generation ahead of us, because there's still a lot of hip hop fans that are Generation Z, because we're in a very artist-centric environment. And we've been there for a long time. We've been there for at least 15 years.
Let's take a break for this week's Chartmetric Stat of the Week. The late XXXTentacion is one of the most successful artists to come from Empire, which is one of the record labels that we talk about in this episode. And it's been nearly 5 years since his death in June 2018, but he's still one of the most popular artists on streaming. As of March 26, 2024, he has over 44 million Spotify listeners, number 23rd on the streaming service, and he has a fan conversion rate that Spotify followers to monthly listeners that averages above 100% for the past 3 years since March 2021. He's an artist with a very complicated legacy, but the fan base is still there. Let's get back to the episode.
When the ringtone era started, there was a new way to sell a single. That to me was when I started looking at the space completely differently. I may not know anything about where Soulja Boy is signed. I just know that when I'm hanging out with my friend Anid and her phone rings, it is Superman That Ho. You know what I mean? Like that ringtone era was a very critical point in the digital sales of music that leaned into what we're now in, which is a very artist-centric approach to monetization.
Because with Soulja Boy, the brand you probably think of first is YouTube. That's where we all saw this video. Or if you're buying the ringtone, you think about it singular or wherever platform that you bought the ringtone from. Those are the brands.
The mediums became bigger brands to me at that point in time. Or at least that was the first time you start seeing a separation, a fragmentation between, you know, an artist and the label. They were so synonymous for so long. I mean, even small things like when people used to watch music videos, the credits on the video would tell you what label it was. And any video with a long intro now is going to get less streams on YouTube. So I'm not even sure if people are paying attention to the openings of the videos or the credits on the videos in the same way. I think the directors stand out more than the label that put out the video.
Because that's another thing that ties back to that shift from institutions to individuals, especially with everything in the streaming era. No one would have patience for that 10-second introductory opening credit of a Hype Williams music video to be like Shady Aftermath presents a Hype Williams video. No, you got to get right to the point.
It's silly. Everyone tries to be Thriller. It's like, yeah, but you know, when they restart that video, they're going to skip your Thriller part. They're going to skip it. Nobody's going to be walking hands. They just want to see Michael dance and they want to see the horror film song. I mean, even on the media side, when I was editor-in-chief of DX, one of our strategies was stand on the shoulders of giants. A lot of times that affected our content strategy in the sense that one, when Twitter showed up, when we put out an article, immediately noticed that the traffic on that article would increase if that artist shared the article, which everybody did in the beginning. We instituted that as an overall strategy. And a lot of times that would also impact the artists we targeted in terms of talking about it in the first place. There were a few niche artists at that time that did really well on our platform that might not have been, you know, as prominent as they are now. Like Lecrae was one of those. Reach Records, Strange Music. They're one of the few labels now to me that's still very defined in their brand identity. Know that the artists are going to have a very visceral live show, and you know that they're going to be left of center in what they're talking about and the perspectives that they're coming from. But we would target the artists in the articles that we wrote because we wanted to bring more fans to the platform ultimately at the end of the day. And so to me, that's another step in this artist-centric approach to everything. Now, I'm not sure what that means for the brand identity of a publication in the same, but I do know that people's fates are tied to the success of these artists or those artists' relationships with whatever that they're marketing and selling. And therefore that your own personal identity tends to be lost within that dynamic.
Because part of this too is thinking about the labels themselves are in this position where they know the dynamic has changed, but who's making an effort to do it and who isn't? And across the board, I feel like we often see that it's the indie labels and the ones that are rising up, no different than the labels you talked about at the beginning of this conversation in the 80s and 90s that were pushing to strive. But the labels that are on top now, the ones that have the market share, those labels in many ways operate more like B2B brands where they're very known and established within the industry. And both you and I know from, you know, being in the industry, we know which labels have a good reputation. We know which labels don't have the best reputation. But do consumers really know that? I look at a label like, let's say, Republic Records, and a label like that that has been respected and regarded as won a bunch of Billboard awards and things like that. But I don't think the average consumer is like, oh yeah, I can't wait for the next Republic Records album to drop. Or even a company like The Orchard, which another one that is respected. Like, you would never see someone wearing an Orchard t-shirt walking around the streets. If you did, you would assume that they work there. Like, it's just not that same type of thing.
And I think that with this mass consolidation, in my mind, I would think that Universal has a billion different labels under it, right? In my mind, I would think that maybe there'd be a Universal compilation with the best artists from all over the place. You know, now legally and from a rights standpoint, we know how challenging that can be. But I feel like compilation albums aren't even as prominent as they were before, which also lets you know, which also increased the brand identity of the label and when it relates to the consumer. You could probably go find any kind of playlist you want to. And maybe that's, you know, sort of the gap bridge there. I think now it sounds more so like they're embracing their role as portfolio companies and banks.
They're leaning into the fact that the artists are more forward than they ever have been. They are the ones that have the brands. How do we be the partner that can support and make sure that this artist can be as strong as they can be? Because the better that they do, the better that we do. So I think that's one part of it. And the other part of it too is that the artists in general, because of this shift, have more power as well. So it's advantageous for the labels to lean into that. And especially once these artists, you know, recoup their advances, and especially if they are maintaining a priority status on the label isn't going to play hardball the same way that they may have 20, 30 years ago. They want to try to keep that artist as long as possible, and they offer them favorable terms, more favorable than any artist that came before them ever would have gotten. But we're in a different era now. These artists can make more money doing different types of things. And as music becomes a smaller and smaller revenue generating stream for these artists specifically, just compared to live and merch and things like that, there is more pressure on the labels to be able to help preserve and maintain, especially for the superstars that they have.
That's why I'm a big fan of what Hive is doing, you know, or has done really with their Weverse platform. That thin slice that brings brand awareness for the label while still maximizing, you know, the notoriety and the reach of the artists. They created an entire platform that houses all the music, behind the scenes stuff, fan meetups, merchandise, ticket sales, live shows. And it's all under the same brand. That it's the brand that the labels are signed to. I think Universal even announced they're trying it with Universe, this YO Universe platform that they think is, you know, that's coming this way. We'll see how that goes. But I think there's also a lot of room for the Republics to do that, for the Warners to do that, especially Def Jam. I mean, I think if there's any brand that has the catalog of a Def Jam Records that doesn't have their own Weverse something right now, you know, is they become a product of whatever their parent company is doing. But that Def Jam brand, that Def Jam logo has a whole lot of power and a lot of weight behind it, too. You know, and I think that that to me is how you bring back brand identity to where people become fans of the brand again. While still maximizing an artist-centric approach. You can have your own YouTube channel, but YouTube is going to give a recommendation to whoever's watching to go look at something else, right? You don't get a chance to capture the square in the same way.
And I think with Weverse as well, we saw this week, the end of March, where Hybe and Universal Music Group signed this deal to be able to have this ongoing partnership. And part of what they said in the release was leveraging the Weverse platform for the Universal artists. So you're exactly right. We are going to see this. And I think it's because the US-based major record labels see what Hybe is doing. Everyone here has been focused on super fans and trying to do this and lean in. Hybe has been doing that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what is it? Super fans are fans who spend revenue on an artist or a platform five different ways. You know, you can make up for the lack of streaming revenue, or as it's been described, that we're in this attention recession by just maximizing the people who care the most. And what's better way to do that than consolidate them into your own ecosystem? You know, I think like, you know, for example, like a bottom-up approach, I think can be successful, but we've seen people run into challenges with that, you know, Warner and Sony specifically. Following 2020, even though this type of consolidation always happens, it's been happening in the music space, record labels or media companies and acquiring publications isn't necessarily a brand new thing. But at the same time, there still is a gap between the margins needed to be successful. If you're acquiring ad-based revenue editorial platform that doesn't necessarily have its own strong brand from an artist-centric standpoint, you know, if you don't necessarily have a whole bunch of super notable or recognizable hosts all over the place, right? There still is that gap between whatever's value added from that acquisition, but also the gap between the consumer and the brand itself. Yeah, you know, this brand X has bought a website, but what's that website doing to really support brand X other than support the artists on brand X? You know what I mean?
Right. So question for you on that, because based on your time as EIC at Hip Hop DX, what were your thoughts when that deal happened?
Tommy's story is so crazy, right? He's a kid from Canada who grew up selling mixtapes. Started it in 1998, 99. It was probably a few months after All Hip Hop. I think OK Player, if I'm not mistaken, is around then. Hip Hop Site is around then. It's a very small blog space. Slept on couches for years. He redirected all the money he had into the business and grew that to a company to be acquired by a Fortune 500 entity. So I was super excited for him. That's the first thing I thought about. The second thing I thought about was like, okay, Uproxx had already been acquired. And so Uproxx's models, they do more sponsor content than DX was doing, right? DX, most of their revenue streams came from the legacy content that they had on the site, maybe a strategic partnership here or there. And then they're growing YouTube, you know, reach. But that was their model. And, you know, I felt like the music industry, especially with streaming, especially with the internet being 20 years old, was at the point where, okay, everything's got to get gobbled up so everything can just spread out again. Uproxx was already there. Their model was a little bit different. DX's brand in the space is much more defined than Uproxx. We didn't know this yet, but we're right around the corner from COVID. So everything boomed. Like, that was the right time. Anybody who didn't sell then, I don't know. Because it felt like there was never enough content in the whole world for anybody. Everything seemed like it was the right acquisition to make. I was curious to wonder how over time, fundamentally for the parent company who's acquiring these things, blogs in general, like a editorial outlet, ultimately, it's pretty slow growth. You have to have a super strong sales team. You have to have a super strong sponsor content division. You probably need to be very forward technologically. Like if you look at, you know, DJ Booth to Audio Mac, like you have to make some sort of shift in the business model. I didn't see DX doing that. When I was EIC, our biggest competitor was Hot New Hip Hop. And the thing that I used to hate more than anything when I would go out into the streets, and I'm talking to other people in the business, in the industry, at the labels, is they would always talk about Hot New Hip Hop's charts. They would say they use their charts. DX didn't have anything like that at that point in time. So I felt like it was a tremendous acquisition for Tommy. I was very happy for him. From a Warner standpoint, it felt like unless things had changed dramatically since I had left, which they hadn't, then they were going to be one of the first ones to get spun off, because the way the world is going, the way consumers are going, an ad-driven content business doesn't have the growth rates necessary to stay attractive to a Fortune 500 multi-conglomerate entity.
I think the company was named IMG that owned the Daquan Instagram account. And I think that deal felt even more like a, okay, this is definitely a deal of the moment where it probably wouldn't make sense several years before this and it wouldn't make sense several years after this. Yeah, I think I talked to Tommy shortly after the deal had happened and was like, hey man, congrats. I mean, I have watched from afar, but I could only imagine what it's like on your end. But yeah, it's interesting with these companies, and you just see even on the catalog side of things, how many times like those assets are getting flipped from whether it's a PE firm like KKR, okay, they had this one and then now they're spinning it off. They're acquiring from this other company. So everyone is experiencing this in some way. And a lot of it is just a reset from, as you put it, what we saw in the pandemic and all of the zero interest rate environment activities that wouldn't make sense now in 2024. But there's something though that I do want to tap into, because I think music, we've seen a lot of this shift, and it's probably the most extreme shift we've probably seen from a medium perspective. But it's interesting to think about movies as well, because I look at some of the newer brands that have come out on the film studio side, like A24 or Neon or a Blumhouse, and they've been able to create distinct brands despite all of the evolutions and changes that we've seen in video streaming. And I do know that video streaming definitely has its differences from audio streaming, but I wanted to chat a little bit about that, because I think one of the key differences, though, is that even for a film studio like A24, the first experience and that first touch point that consumers have is still going to the theater to see these films. Yeah, sure, they may end up on HBO Max several months later, but it's still going to the theater. You're going to the theater to say, hey, I want one ticket to see Everything Everywhere all at once. So it isn't just like you're popping in and then the algorithm is playing that for you the way that it exists in Spotify or some of the other DSPs. So that was one of the distinctions there. But it's been, I think, cool on the video side to see these brands exist. And part of me wish that we could still see even more of this on the audio side, but I know the dynamics are different.
In a weird way, you know, I think Blumhouse and A24 specifically capitalize on the three C's, you know what I mean? Like community, characters, and convenience. Now, maybe it's not the most convenient anymore to go to a movie, but these movies hit streaming pretty quickly. But they're all very strong character-driven scripts that they are presenting in their product. I'm not an expert on their balance sheets by any means, and I'm not sure how much money they're spending on these films. It looks like they do a whole lot. They maximize a budget. You know, you're not seeing super crazy CGI everywhere and, you know, spending grotesquely on making things seem Earth-sized all the time. And I think there's a lot of room for that in music at the same time right now, too. Like, even Mellow Music Group, that's another niche brand, I would say, niche-sized label that is very defined in the type of artists that they're going to put out. You know, you're going to get a Marv One or a Homeboy Sandman. And I think that there is riches in niches. I don't think that that can ever be disregarded. And if you hit the right notes, create the right magic, success is only time away.
And we have seen some of this happen in music in that same way. I look at a company like Empire, starts off with distribution, shorter term deals, having a very different model from what the majors are doing, and then really became synonymous with the SoundCloud hip hop era and having some of the biggest artists on the platform. I also look at a company like Create that lead more into the creators and TikTok oriented type of music creator, just given how much influence that platform has had. So we do see these things. Granted, brands like Empire and Create still a bit behind the scenes, maybe relative to some of the consumer facing things. But I do think the respect and the desire for artists, once they kind of get to a certain level of wanting to be associated with those companies, is there.
Empire is really interesting, right? Because I feel like of that level of label, I think from a brand identity standpoint, especially considering they don't have super well-known, I would say, flagship artists like a Kendrick or like a J. Cole, but they put a lot of energy into their brand identity. Okay, I got a pair of Empire sweatpants that just has the symbol on it, and people know what that is. Consumer facing, maybe a little bit less, but they're also diversified in some of their retail businesses. They're still a little bit more behind the scenes, definitely. They have a keen eye on brand awareness, brand identity. But there was that year where a handful of Empire artists died. They got shot. They all got murdered, right? And the conversation around Empire was, that's what Empire, all they do is hire the violent rappers. By no means are they promoting that, I can say that. By no means are they telling people to be more violent, but that's what the marketplace is dictating. You could arguably say the same thing about Interscope. There was a point in time where if you weren't violent, you weren't Interscope. Or if you weren't violent, you better be Will.i.am, because they weren't doing anything in the middle. And that's what happens when you live at the polls from a strategic standpoint, from a publication standpoint. Okay, we're going to give things tens or we're going to give them twos. Like, you live and die with living on those polls, and a lot of times your reputation ends up being the extremes that, at the same time, I think the Grammys that they've won were for PJ Morton, I think, what most rap fans would associate with Empire.
Yeah, living on the edges, that's a good point, especially thinking back to Interscope and Jimmy Iovine. And I feel like there was this whole model of, if this artist didn't make some older person clutch their pearls when they watch the music video or listen to the music, then no, they're not a fit here. That was the whole brand.
I mean, it definitely achieved market penetration. The worst thing you can do is be in the middle. No one remembers who barely made the playoffs or barely missed the playoffs. You remember who came in first place? You remember who came in last place?
So when it comes to being remembered for these labels, especially on the consumer side, What does the ceiling look like today? It's probably unrealistic for us to compare to the 90s with Uptown or Bad Boy or LaFace or anything like that. But is it what Empire's doing right now? Is it what QC was doing for a couple of years there?
I mean, it's really limitless. You know, I think that one, the desire to have a strong brand identity needs to be there. I think that there's a lot of circular, insular thinking when you're around a bunch of other industry professionals in any space. And so a lot of the acknowledgement and awareness comes from winning Grammy Awards or Billboard Awards. And I think that speaks loudly within those circles, but it not necessarily in the same way with the consumer. Once a label decides that it cares about this, then I think it's limitless because the technology is more affordable than ever on most sides. Well, I don't know. It depends on how this looks, right? If Universal is putting their artists on Weverse and doesn't make it prominent to users that these are Universal artists, you know, that to me is an opportunity lost. They're leaving something on the table. Even as simple as an OTT network that runs your entire catalog and is accessible on an app that has just your artists, that will make penetration. I mean, these portfolio companies and banks at this point in time, they can invest cool niches or even merchandising. You know, they can structure the contracts where they have the artists have to represent them more. There's limitless possibilities. The question is if there's an appetite to do so. A lot of the companies that we do remember that have achieved that type of penetration also have very face-forward CEOs and leaders. These institutions can start to prioritize their own individual brands. And to me, I think it's to their detriment if they don't. That's a lot of money left on table. Any point in time, brand in the music industry or in any creative field can have that impact on their consumers. It's just if the appetite is there.
Especially when we're talking about super fans and all of that. How do you engage with them? You get them to buy these products. Because right now, the most identifiable way that a lot of consumers know what a Universal artist is whether or not they can currently stream that artist's music on TikTok, but they realize that they can't because of this ongoing turf battle that's going on. That's the only reason that someone would know that, oh, Drake's on Universal. Okay, I guess that wouldn't have been the case there. I think we'll see this evolve. I think you're right. It's in their interest. And I'm definitely rooting for the underdogs, the upstarts, because they're the ones that are exciting, right? So we'll continue to see how this grows and develops. Justin, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks again. And hopefully we can do this again sometime soon on another topic, but appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me, man. I'd love to. Big fan of yours. Much respect to you for everything you've built. Trapital is one of these companies that is just waiting on some merchandise to be fire everywhere. You know what I mean? That Trapital name can be on anything. I'd wear a pair of Trapital pants.
Oh, you're onto something. All right. Maybe I need to get that Trapital Mac Weldon collaboration in the books. Appreciate you, man. Thank you.
No doubt.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.